this is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book, coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. Whoa, this is going to be fun. I'm waiting here for a call in from somebody in Europe, and I hope that it comes through soon because we have been waiting for him. Meanwhile, I want to talk a little bit about, a lot of things, actually. And one thing that sort of hit me today as I discovered that a writer who listens to my program has sort of fallen for one of these traps where you get an email like one of the Nigerian ones, this one is directed to writers. And so often this is happening now as you connect more, as writers connect more on the internet and you have your books out there on Amazon, people realize that you're interested in promoting your books and they come out with all sorts of schemes that are supposed to help you. And I want to warn everybody not to fall for these schemes because you get these emails and they say for a certain amount of money, you know, $499, we will help you promote your book. And then when you don't answer them right away, then they come to you and they say for $399. And they go on until finally it sounds really reasonable. And maybe for $250, you say, okay, I'm going to try it because these people are in the business. They know how to promote books and they want to help me. Or even in a worst case situation, sometimes these scams are directed to you in the hopes that you will use them in order to take your book from a book into a screenplay. And they offer you the same kind of service. They give you so much money and they say, okay, we're going to turn your book into a screenplay and we're going to get it in front of producers and you're going to be rich and famous in no time at all. Actually, they don't add that no time at all because they usually are very clever and they say it takes years of work so that you won't come back to them until they're out of business and far away from wherever they were when you first hired them. So really do not fall for these scams. If you get these emails, you know, I know it is difficult sometimes to resist because it sounds so promising. And the better, sometimes the better it sounds, it means that they've been at this a while and they've learned what things to tap into, how to tap into your need for help. And so I will tell you one thing, having, you know, I mentioned before, I had three of my scripts optioned in Hollywood. I've written several screenplays for books. And that is not the way to go about it. You cannot take one of these companies and have them write a screenplay for you and tell you that they are going to put it in front of an agent in Hollywood because no agent is going to look at it. That's not the way it's done in Hollywood. And it won't get you anywhere. All it will get you is it'll get you a big headache and you will end up really being very, very unhappy and losing a lot of money. So I do want to warn you. If you're interested, you know, very few authors actually can turn their own books into screenplays. Some authors actually can turn other people's books into screenplays, but your own book is so personal and you know it so well and you imagine it exactly in one way. And it is hard for you to just walk away from it and say, I have to cut this, I have to cut this. And it's, I was working on adaptation of a book into a screenplay. And as I'm reading the book and I realize, you know, I like the book, it's really an excellent book, but there's so much, you know, in a book you can't use. And then I also knew just from reading the book and the subject of the book, there was so much that the writer did not have in it. Having lived in the area where this person's book takes place, I knew that many opportunities for scenes were not in the book. So what did I do? I could have stuck straight to the book and said, okay, I'm only going to use exactly what's there. Or I could expand it and use scenes and use locations that I know would be, from a film point of view, perfect. Because if all of the scenes took place in one location, because in the book, that's where they took place. But in a film, you might want to spread it out over three locations, four locations. You want to make it interesting, especially if it's in a foreign city and you want more than what's in the book. And for an author, this is a very difficult thing to imagine. It's hard to put it into words. You see the book in your head. You know the dialogue. And that's also a big problem, because dialogue in a book is so much different from dialogue in a script. If you watch a movie, you see how actually little dialogue there is today compared even to years ago, where there was really dialogue where actors spoke a lot of lines, and not just a few actors. Nowadays in a film, as you'll notice, there are very few actors who get to actually speak, because everyone who speaks costs money. So I love old Hollywood movies where you'll have all of the extras will get a line or two lines because they were on contract and it didn't cost them any money and they didn't have to get a SAG card and they didn't. So it was very nice. But the problem is that you have to think in a different way when you're writing a script. The dialogue is different. I know when I was interviewing Lee Child, we talked very briefly, because he really doesn't want to talk too much about the Jack Reacher films. Because if you know Lee Child's books, Jack Reacher in his books is, Lee sort of was thinking of himself as Jack Reacher. Jack Reacher's tall and handsome and blonde. And then along comes Tom Cruise, who buys the rights to the books. And, of course, that changes the look of the character. Now, if you're writing a script, and if you put that in a script, you know, if you are sort of attached to it, then you could not imagine anybody but a 6'5" blonde guy playing the character, it wouldn't work. As a matter of fact, in a script, you do very little description of what the people look like. Because it can change. You don't, generally speaking, unless it's absolutely necessary, you don't say this person's fat or this person's blonde, this person. You don't say it because in a script, because any actor might be chosen to play the part. So it's a whole different mindset. And I hope that all of you who are thinking and dreaming about having your books made into scripts won't you know, go that route where you're going to spend money for it. One of the companies that I just recently heard about, they charge $14,000. $14,000 to take your book and turn it into a script. Now, of course, it is true that a real script writer would not do a script for less than $25,000. So first of all, if you're getting somebody who's doing something for $14,000, they probably really don't know what they're doing. But the whole thing is that you would get nowhere with somebody doing a script on your book, because anybody who's going to buy your book will read your book. They will actually read it when it comes to writing the script. When a real script person is given the job to write a script based on a book, they actually read it. It's not that they don't read it. So you're in a different ball game, and I don't want any more people to lose, whether it's $197 or $499 or whatever they are charging. Stop and do some real investigation, and then probably stop again and don't do it, because There is no, I just can't think of anyone who's been successful that way. And I know that there are a lot of people who have lost a lot of money. If you're really interested in getting ahead, if you have an idea, if your books, if you feel your books are really ready for the big screen, and of course, if you've published it independently, you're right there. You have a strike against you. You're going to have to try to do something completely different, another way to get to Hollywood. But the only way really is to make connections. And the best way for a writer to make real connections, lifelong connections, is to attend a workshop where you're working with professional writers, professional agents, professional publicists who will tell you the truth too, because sometimes you think that you're ready for prime time, but you're not. And if you go to a workshop, they can be brutally honest with you. A good workshop. If it's a good workshop where the writers are really professional and the agents are professional, they aren't going to play games with you. They will tell you, okay, you need to step back. You need to rewrite this. You need to maybe start from the beginning, start a new book, and learn from your mistakes. So again, it's all a part of being a determined writer. If you think that you are going to, you have something to tell and you want a story to tell people and you're determined to get it out there, then it's very important that you take this on as a professional experience. And just like if you were going to, if you're a doctor and you're going to learn a new procedure, you're going to one of these conferences where they teach you how to suture things a little bit differently to make it better. Well, you're going to take the advice of the people that are teaching you. So again, if you're looking for a way to get ahead, and for indie writers who are out of the mainstream of the big publishing world, and you want to sort of dip your toe in or make connections, well thought out, well planned workshop is the best way to go. Now, I'm going to have a new webpage coming up in the next day or two, and I won't have immediately a list of workshops, but I'm going to be working with some very important people like Jonathan Santlaffer, who was on recently to talk about a book that he's been involved in. And I want to find workshops where you will really meet important people and be able to work with important people. And while I'm thinking about that, if you're serious, if you have money, instead of wasting your money on one of these groups that send you these emails and try to entice you to spend big money, go to IreneGoodman.com and look at her critique at the first of every month, which is, of course, what's today? The 31st, right? Tomorrow? Oh, today's the 1st. What am I saying? It is the 1st of February, which, by the way, I have to stop everything. It's the 1st of February. It is my sister's birthday. It is Natalie's birthday. And I already said good morning to her once early, early in the morning, but I'm not sure she was all that awake. So now I want to say happy birthday to my sister, Natalie. Natalie is quite an amazing person. And so now my mind is on her. She is one of the things that I know that she would like me to tell everybody is you should read and you should go to the library. She has found so much joy in going to the library and every few weeks getting a nice pile of books and going through them. And, you know, sometimes she'll find a book that she doesn't like and she'll just put it aside. And then often she'll have just a wonderful experience of finding a new author that she hadn't read before. And of course, when she does that, she immediately comes to me and says, oh, you have to get this author on. You have to talk to this author. And so she is a connoisseur of cozy mysteries. She loves cozy mysteries. So she brings me a lot to read and to invite the authors on, and I love that. But one of the things that she's discovered, and when she retired, the books that are sort of health books, first she went into crocheting, and so she'd get all these books on crocheting, and in no time at all, she was making beautiful, beautiful things. And then recently she got into origami again, all from books that she found at the library. And now she makes origami that's absolutely professional looking and quite amazing. So I want to say happy birthday to Natalie and thank her for everything she does for me and everything she does for Joy on Paper, because she always helps me find new authors and just generally encourages me in everything. So I want to say happy birthday to her. And now I'm going to take a quick commercial break, and we're going to go and we're going to try to see if we can find out what happened to our guest. I don't know. He was there. He's in Belgium. We'll see.
Radio Network.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at larsonpatentlaw.com.
Hello, I'm Mike Lindell, inventor of My Pillow. My employees and I would like to thank you for making My Pillow possible. Years ago, when I invented My Pillow, I thought I was the only one out there with problems sleeping. Pillows would go flat, I'd flip-flop all night or wake up with a sore neck or headache. So that's why I invented My Pillow. You can adjust MyPillow's patented fill to your exact individual needs to help you get to sleep faster and stay there longer to get the quality sleep you need. I back it with my 10-year warranty and my 60-day money-back guarantee. And now to thank you, I'm bringing back my best offer ever. Buy one of my MyPillows and get another one absolutely free.
Support Joy on Paper and local authors. Go to MyPillow.com and use promo code PATSY. P-A-T-Z-I. Love a good book? Then the Book Swap of Carolwood is the place for you. They carry both new and used books. Looking for a cozy mystery, books for the kids, or a great thriller? They've got it all. So head over to the Book Swap of Carolwood, located at 11738 North Dale Mabry in Tampa. Valentine's Day is coming soon. Stop in and meet the friendly staff who will help you find the perfect gift. Remember, 11738 North Dale Mabry in Tampa. Book Swap of Carolwood has been part of the North Tampa community since 1984.
This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
With a Z, and I am back, and we are still waiting for my very special guest today. I don't know what's happening. We are trying to get him, and if he gets on, we'll cut to him. But meanwhile, and that's Andrew Scott Cooper, and I am so interested and excited to talk to him about his book, particularly because I had been there and I know something about it, The Fall of Heaven, the story behind the Shah of Iran and the Pahlavis. So we might still get him. You never know if this is live radio, and that's one of the exciting things about it. Now, my thoughts were interrupted when I stopped to say happy birthday to my sister, but I wanted to, again, to remind you that Irene Goodman offers a critique. It starts on the 1st of the month, and that's today. And if you go to her website, you can see it's an auction. So at every month, it's the price is a little different. I don't know what it'll be this month, but as many people as possible should try to jump in the auction. And if you are lucky enough to win the bid, then she will do a critique for you, which will be absolutely wonderful. From one of the best literary agents in the business. She knows what she's talking about. And I will have also, I will have on my website, I will have her example and her story about query letters. So if you have any questions about that, you have to come to my new website in a few days, and it will help you, because Irene knows what she's talking about. She has brought so many writers to great, great success, and she's one of those agents who follows her authors. They take them. They have a major program to make sure that their authors have long and successful careers. So I hope that you will try that. It's IreneGoodman.com, and all the money goes to charity. So that's wonderful. And I wanted to again remind you that I was so enjoyed my guest the other day, Stephanie and Adam of Fit Couple Cooks. If you haven't ever seen that show on the on YouTube, it is really fun. And their book, Healthy Meal Prep, Time-Saving Plans to Prep and Portion Your Weekly Meals, is really nice. I was really happy. Is he okay? Okay. Are we on? Hello? Maybe. Andrew, are you there?
Hi, can you hear me?
I hear you. I hear you, Andrew. Oh, this is exciting. I'm so happy. Okay. I don't know. Technology. How are you?
Yes. I'm fine. Thank you very much.
Okay. Well, I'm so happy because now I can stop talking and you can talk. So we have on the air Andrew Scott Cooper, and you are such an amazing author. And we're going to talk about The Fall of Heaven, The Pahlavis, and the Final Days of Imperial Iran. Because as I mentioned to you, I think it's so important. You know, unfortunately, we have, it's just human nature that people follow one story at a time. And Iran is so important. And I think people should know more about Iran. And,
yes.
You know, there's such a lack of understanding of what Iran is, and the potential of Iran becoming an ally. The Iranian people are fantastic. And
yes.
I so hope that there can be a deeper understanding of Iran. And I think it will start with your book, because you capture a very important period of time. So tell us about the Fall of Heaven, and tell us something for listeners who don't know a little bit about the history of Iran.
So my work and both my books, the latest is The Fall of Heaven, are really looking at exploring the period when the United States and Iran enjoyed a very close relationship during the Cold War, particularly during the 1970s. And I agree with you. I think the history is very important. And in fact, I don't think the two countries can really move past the events of 1979 with the revolution, unless historians start to dig into that period. And what's happening now is we have access to declassified documents from the Nixon, Ford, and Carter administrations. And so we have a much bigger, much better picture of what was really going on inside the Carter White House during the fall of the Shah, but also what was going on in the palace. And that's really what I wanted to look at. As someone who, I mean, I love history. I've been reading history books since I was a kid. And I have never seen anyone explain to me what it was like for the Shah and the royal family and their entourage during the collapse in 1978-79. So the book is really takes you inside the palace. And I was very fortunate to have access to the late Shah's widow, Empress Farah, to the royal family, and to the people who knew the Shah the best, so that I could reconstruct events on a day-by-day basis.
Well, I think it is important that people have a more nuanced understanding of the Shah, because all you know, is in the minds of most people is, oh, he's a bad guy, you know. And there was such a depth to him, and he had so many hopes for his country, that I think it is important that people understand a little bit more about him. And, of course, his wife, who was absolutely and is absolutely brilliant.
Yes. I mean, you know, when we look at the Shah today, scholars and historians look at the Shah, we see someone different to the person that I think a lot of people saw in 1979 when he left the country. I think, with 40 years behind us, we can look at the Shah and see that he had actually embarked on this remarkable program of social and economic reforms to try and bring a very poor country into the 20th century. And also, it's important to remember, actually, that he achieved great successes during that time. Just focus on the issue of women's rights. The reason why so many young Iranians today are angry with their parents and grandparents for demonstrating against the Shah and the royal family is because women in Iran do not enjoy the same freedoms that they had under the Shah, that the personal liberties that he was trying to bring in have actually been, vanquished. So we now look back at the Shah, and I think there's much more empathy and understanding on the part of not only scholars, but also inside Iran. It's very important. Americans, I don't think they understand the extent to which there is a whole revival of popular interest in the royal family, not just in the Shah, but, you know, today Empress Farah is regarded as an absolute icon, especially among young Iranian women who write to her in the tens of thousands. And, she is still doing work today. This is not someone who in exile has put her feet up and is spending her day shopping. She is a very hardworking person. If you're in contact with the Empress, you'll get texts from her at 10 and 11 o'clock at night because she is working 7 days a week. And so for her, you know, the revolution obviously led to a great change personally, but she still retains that connection with the Iranian people.
Well, the Shah had really these goals of bringing Iran into the future, to make sure that Iranians were prepared. And unfortunately, you know, people don't understand that there are so many good things that he did for the country.
Yeah. And he achieved many successes. And I think that Iranians today, when they look back, are much more sympathetic towards what he was trying to do. I think there was a profound misunderstanding at the time about his goals. This was someone who was not a very good public speaker. The Shah was not someone who could come out. He was not, first of all, not comfortable with crowds. He was a very shy man, and he preferred surrounding himself with experts. So he was not a good person on the street. And by contrast to the Empress, who, as I sort of describe it during the revolution, made it several remarkable forays into demonstrating crowds to try and assure people that the security forces, the Shah, was still going to survive. But I think the Shah had this program. He was encouraged by the United States and by Western governments to modernize and westernize Iran. He went very fast. I think that everyone agrees today that he tried to do too much too soon. But when you're in Iran, as I was 4 years ago, you actually see what he built. And I think that's one reason why historians look back today and sort of we can see that his work was not expunged or destroyed by the revolutionaries. Actually, they took his projects and his work and built on it and then claimed it as their own.
Now, when you how did you get involved with this project? What was the impetus for this?
Well, I read history books starting from the age of about 7, 8 years old. And I was 8 years old when the revolution happened. And, you know, like a lot of people, I watched it on TV. I grew up in New Zealand. And as I grew older, I always expected someone to write the definitive account of what happened so that I could understand. Because I think it's anytime you talk about a big revolution like the French or Russian Iranian revolutions, you know, we're talking about the epic sweep of history here. And it is remarkable that the literature on what happened in Iran in the 1970s is so thin. And it is dominated by a particular type of political scientist. Most of the books were written in the early 80s. The literature is outdated and does not reflect the declassified information we have now. So I was living in New York in 2006. I was in an office job. I was really bored. And I decided that I was going to change my life. But I wanted to start a part-time history research project before I made the plunge back into history studies. So I was the first scholar to access the papers of General Brent Scowcroft, who I think some of your readers will remember. Well, he's a fantastic guy. He's still around. And he was Kissinger's deputy under Nixon and Ford, and then he became Ford's last national security advisor. Those transcripts have revolutionized our way of looking at how the Shah handled relations with the U.S. This is not a guy who was a puppet. This is someone who actually was controlling the relationship, especially after the oil shock. And I think that when that narrative came out in my first book, Oil Kings, it opened the door for me to do the book that I had always wanted to do, which was an inside the palace account of how the royal household dealt with the rise of Islamic fundamentalism and what went wrong. And I think it's really important that when we look at the Middle East today and we see what's happened in Syria and Libya, we have to try and understand the collapse that happened in Iran in 1978-79, because this was the first domino to fall in a way. And I think that not enough work has been done looking at what happened, and also trying to understand how did the U.S. respond and how did U.S. Officials, Carter administration officials, what mistakes did they make when they were trying to help the Shah towards the end or not help him?
Now, it's fascinating that someone who was not a history. You were just doing a regular job and yeah. You decided yeah. to step into it. That's wonderful, because that's, you know, it's encouraging, I think, to everybody out there who has in the back of their mind that they want to write, because, wow, first of all, you come out with the Oil Kings, which was so well received and so popular. And I think, you know, the reason that I wanted to talk to you about this book, the new book, is because, as I said, I hope that we can see a change in that Iranians, you know, the younger generation Iranians and the old ones who remember those days of the Shah, love America, and they didn't want to be enemies of America. And I think that we have such potential there that if we start to understand the country and to understand what, for example, the Shah was trying to do and why he wanted to do it, there might be hope for peace.
Well, I absolutely believe that. And, you know, there's this saying that the Iranian people are the most pro-American. Iran has the most pro-American population in the Middle East and the most anti-American government. And I think that's so true, because if you've ever been fortunate enough to travel to Iran, and you can, American
and
tourists.
And I have.
So you know how beautiful it is, and you know how warm and hospitable the Iranian people are. I mean, you're practically treated as a celebrity when you go. It's quite... It is a revelation, and I think that I was so struck at over the Christmas holiday, New Year break holidays, when we had this recent round of unrest in Iran. Now, the first couple of days, crowds were out in the streets chanting in support of the late Shah and the Shah's son, Reza Pahlavi, who lives in exile in the United States. They were chanting in support of the royal family, even though the royal family left 39 years ago. On February 10th is the anniversary of the revolution. And they were comparing the Islamic Republic to the monarchy. And I think that when you know, clearly the younger generation of Iranians is way, way ahead of where many Americans are. I'm still struck by the fact that when I talk to other Americans, well, they ask, you know, what do you write about? And I say, I write about the Shah. And they say, oh, he was so bad, or he was the butcher. You know, there's so much more that we now know about the situation inside Iran in the 1970s. It's a much more nuanced picture, as you rightly said. And the United States, I think people are living, we're trapped in this bubble of 1979. I think the Iranians have actually moved much farther along than we have. We're still living with this image of people burning flags and the hostages and the whole thing. I think the Iranian people want to rejoin the international community. I think they have a government, a regime that they generally hate, but they're stuck with it at the moment. You know, and I think that we have to hopefully be a little supportive and understanding of the fact they have a government that they don't like.
And I think this book will help people. First of all, it's a good read. You know, I always like a book that just flows, very well written, fascinating. Tell us a little bit more about the Empress, because I think that's it probably is one of the keys to why your book is so interesting, because she is such a fascinating person. You know, she was trained as an architect. She was, you know, a substantial monarch. You know, I think nobody understands what she is like.
Well, she, in the book, you know, I say that she is the most influential female sovereign and accomplished female sovereign of the 20th century. And actually, you go back to Catherine the Great of Russia to look for another woman on the throne who has really had as much many resources at her disposal. You know, I was very conscious of the fact that with oil kings, I was essentially writing about the men in power, and I wanted to have a woman's perspective in the book. I felt that was very important. One of the gripes I had, frankly, with my editor was that she, you know, the book was cut. This book was cut by 100,000 words. This is another 100 pages. But a lot of the stuff taken out was actually from the perspectives of American women who were in Tehran during the revolution. I thought their viewpoints were fantastic. But anyway, but I've really fought to have Farah's voice in there, because here's someone who is not wielding political power, but she's right in the heart of the power center with her husband. And she had, her instincts were so correct the whole way through. And in fact, one of the things I find fascinating about her today still is her understanding of public relations and how to talk to people. She is a very, very empathetic person. She is very kind. I think all Iranians, regardless of their political views, respect her, and many of them love her. She actually has told me this fantastic story where, you know, she was on a plane flying from Paris some years ago, and an Iranian ambassador was on the same flight, and he came over and he talked to her and he said, "I want to thank you for all the work you did, the social programs that you developed in Iran, because, you know, we took what you did and built on them." So she was very young, of course, when she met the Shah. She was 19 years younger than him. So she had a different generational outlook. She had a very sort of keen social conscience, because she was from that post-war generation. And she surrounded herself in the palace with her own entourage of younger, more intellectual Iranians who had been, many of them had been educated like she had been educated in France. So there was a sort of a Francophile atmosphere around her circle. And there were some clashes there with her husband's circle. Her husband was more conservative. He was older. The men around him distrusted her. They thought she was too liberal. And that led, I think, to some unfortunate splits in the imperial court through the 1970s and towards the end. But in the book, I detail a couple of stories that you'll be familiar with, Patsy, which is that she fought to the end. You know, her husband really gave up sort of in the early fall of 1978, but Farah fought on, and she paid a secret visit to Saddam Hussein in Baghdad, which I detail. And this story has been rumored about, but actually she told me it in detail. And I thought it was such a striking example of how she refused to accept what was happening. And she believed that they should stay in the country. She opposed the departure at the end. And she even said to her husband, look, let me stay on. If you have to leave, I will stay here and represent the royal family. And he said, no, it's finished. We're finished. We have to leave.
Well, how much different the world would have been if she had managed to stay on, because things went bad pretty quickly, and the Iranians discovered that they got involved in a war with Iraq that cost the lives of so many, many Iranians. And it's such a tragic... again, Americans don't... It's hard, you know, for anybody when there's... It's such a complicated situation to put it all straight. But I think it is important. And I think by putting this human face on the Shah, because... as you said, everybody thinks he was just the most horrible person. You know, they use him as a example of the most horrible person who ever lived. And it's so untrue and so unfair. So that's why I think this book serves a great purpose. And I hope that people will pick it up and read it. As I said, it's very readable. And it's a good thing they didn't make you take out Farah, because this is the... I think the most fascinating for me, I found those sections the most fascinating, because I wanted to know what was going on at the end, what was going on in the palace. And you really have created a wonderful picture of that.
Well, thank you. And I'm very happy to say that the paperback is coming out in May. And I've been sort of lobbying for that for the past year. And because Iran is now back in the news, and the scenes that we saw with the protesters calling for the royal family to come back, my publisher agreed that we would now, they would republish the book in soft cover. So that will come out in May.
Well, so you see, I'm ahead of the game. I saw that it was important. I mean, I recognize the importance of this book. I said, people have to read this book, because it's so necessary for people to have a wider understanding of what the situation is in the Middle East in general. Just quickly, because most people don't understand, they hear Iran, they hear Persia, and explain to people what that means. Because, of course, I know, but tell why we hear both words used.
You hear both words. I mean, the Persian, Iran, the Persia was renamed Iran by the late Shah's father, Reza Shah, in the early 1930s. So Persia became Iran. However, today you will hear Iranians who were in the older Iranians in particular prefer to say that they speak Persian rather than Farsi, because they associate Farsi with a province, and they sort of associate it more with the Islamic Republic. So within the Iranian community as well, the diaspora, there is this it's a little bit of a debate over whether we say that we are Persian or we are Farsi speakers. But Persia became Iran under the Shah's father. And so when we talk about the Persian Empire, there's sort of this continuity from sort of 2,500 years through. And in my first couple of chapters, I do a very quick skim, just putting all of this in context, so that by the time you get into when the Shah comes to the throne in 1941, you have a general understanding of what came before him. It is a wonderful, wonderful country. I'm always concerned when I hear the so-called experts on cable TV talking about Iran. I seriously doubt that many of them have ever opened or read a book on the country, and it's very sad to me, because I think that fortunately we have interviewers like you who are trying to bring different perspectives to your audiences, and we really have to go out there and find these sources ourselves. But they are out there, and Iran is not going away. I think Iran is turning, and my book has become an underground commodity in Iran. It's been smuggled into the country. It's been actually being translated right now, and people are disguising it, wrapped in sweet boxes, and taking it to their parents and things like that. So there's a real appetite inside Iran, and I hope people understand when they read the book where the interest comes from.
Oh, I think, oh, that's wonderful. I love to hear that story. As somebody who loves history as much as you do, I think that's a fantastic story, because as I want Iran to be an ally and not an enemy. And that we have that potential if we play it right, if we're smart and not listen to some of these idiots on television who, as you say, know nothing about Iran. And and they're just talking. They get such ideas, I don't know where. And your book is an important book, and I'm so glad that they are bringing it out in paperback. So I will keep talking about it, and maybe you'll come back, and we will talk about that. And about those 100,000 words, what are you going to do with those extra 100,000 words that are floating around your head?
Oh, God, that was heartbreaking, because I was only given several weeks to cut the manuscript, and that was... there's a whole story behind this book, which I came into book writing as someone who'd read a lot of history, but I came in from the outside, and it's been a fascinating journey. And I like to think that someone out there, especially young people who love history, you can do this. I mean, to teach myself about Iran, I went back to school. I did a second master's degree, and I did a PhD in addition to writing the two books, because I wanted to educate myself. I wanted to go back to school, and I wanted to do this properly. I didn't want to write another book that would be dated within another year. I went to Iran. I studied Shiism in a seminary-style school in Qom, which, as you know, is the theological center for Shiism in Iran. And I really have... I'm a very meticulous researcher, and I love the research process. So it's always a joy for me to know the people, read the book, appreciate it.
And to know the food. You got to eat the food. And that's one of the best things about Iran, the food.
Yes. It's so fresh. Everything in Iran is unprocessed, because Iran has been isolated for so long. And that's what I was struck by, the food. I was struck by how lovely the people were. They're actually really unspoiled.
They are, and I hope they don't. When they get more modernized, I don't want them to change their food, because to have that Barbary straight out of the oven with butter, it's like heaven. And speaking of that, and that's funny that it is. Their bread is like heaven, and the name of your book is The Fall of Heaven. The Pahlavis and the Final Days of Imperial Iran, and it's available on, it's going to be in paperback in May, and you can still get it in Amazon, and I don't know where else books are sold, but it's an important book, and I hope that people will get it. I hope you'll come back in May, and we'll talk more, because I'd like to talk more about, I think you're an inspiration to everybody who dreams about writing and then makes a decision to do so. Okay?
It's possible. Yes. Yes, you can do it. Yes, I'm living proof of that.
Okay. Yeah. Well, Andrew, I want to thank you so much. It's been fun. And I think you've done a great job with the book, and I will encourage everyone to read it. So
thank you very much for your support.
Okay. And we'll have you back in May. Okay? Is that a deal?
Okay. Okay. Excellent. I'll be
back. Okay. Bye-bye now. Hold the affairs. Okay. Good. Okay, we got him on. So that was exciting. A little bit of things here. We didn't know what we were doing for a few minutes there. But I don't know. I didn't do Skype before. I don't think we did Skype before. Did we do Skype before, Ed? No, that's the first time Ed and I have done Skype. I think Ed's done Skype before, but the first time for me. So I got it. We finally got it right. And I'm very happy that I managed to get, this book, as I said, is important. And I think it will be for most people, you know, it's an eye opener. It's definitely an eye opener. So Andrew Scott Cooper, and it's called The Fall of Heaven, the Pahlavis, and the Final Days of Imperial Iran. And I hope you'll get that. And meanwhile, I want to tell you, everybody, go this weekend to watch The Fit Couple Cooks. I love this book. They sent it to me, and it's really cool. It's got all sorts of wonderful recipes. And the nice thing about it, all of the recipes are designed that you cook one day a week. So maybe Sunday afternoon, you turn that into your day of cooking. And all the instructions are here, and all it's filled with lovely pictures of exactly how to do everything. And then you cook on Sunday afternoon and you have the food for the entire week, except if you go out one evening. So it's really nice. I think this is a great book. And I also just got Tim Dorsey's The Pope of Palm Beach, and I'm hoping that he will come in here into the studio so that we can talk to him about that, because I love his Coconut Cowboy. It's one of my favorite books here. All of his books, of course, are set, Tim Dorsey's books are set here in Florida. He goes around the state, and he loves to have all sorts of Florida history. And if you are interested in Florida and you just want to know more about where you're going when you're here, they are just wonderful books to get. So all of his books, I think from the very first, he started with going from one place to another and giving us details about restaurants and roads and all sorts of places. So you will enjoy Tim Dorsey, and I hope that he will come in here soon. I also have some more book buzzes coming up, because Rita Moreau was in here earlier today taping some things. So I've got lots of things happening, and I hope that everybody will just check out my website next week. But meanwhile, go to Facebook and like me on Facebook and follow me on Twitter, because it really helps. And make sure that you get go to MyPillow.com and use my promo code PATZI. PATZI, that's easy to remember, and get a pillow, because you need one for a good night's sleep. And I'm going to say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. Thanks, Ed. We finally did it. And he's saluting me, and I'm saluting him. And he's such a dear sweetie pie. Okay. Bye-bye now.